Good evening. Another very long day. Amazing how long they are. You doing okay? Tenzo working so hard back there. Everybody working so hard. First of all, Jane asked me if I would elucidate some of what we chant without really quite knowing what it is. The meal chant gives the names of Buddha. Let us recite the names of Buddha. And then there are these long gobbledygook kind of sounding names, and everybody wonders, who are they? So, I won't give a long scholarly explanation, but it's helpful to know. The trikayas are the three bodies of Buddha. It's a concept that came up around the same time as the Mahayana. The idea of bodhisattva practice and the idea that Shakyamuni Buddha was what we call Buddha, an awakened being who was the founder of this practice, the teacher of this practice. But that Buddha has a much bigger meaning. In fact, a meaning so big we can't even fathom it. And the way it's expressed is with these three kayas. Dharma Kaya Vairochana Buddha. Sambhoga Kaya Ruchana Buddha. Nirmana Kaya Shakyamuni Buddhas. The image that was given to me is of the sun as Dharmakaya. Of course, it's a very, very limited view of what has no limit. Dharmakaya is the limitless, absolute. The whole catastrophe is what John Dido Laurie calls it. The whole entire catastrophe. The dynamic that we call the universe. But the universe in this sense includes all the many universes. And even beyond that. It's the source, you could say, although actually there's no beginning and no end. So it's a little misleading to call it the source, but in the sense that the sun is beaming down on us and we are fired by the sun. Dharmakaya is the sun and Sambhogakaya is the beams. And Nirmanakaya is us. All the many beings that are taking shape and being embodied and enacted by the power of this great fire that we mostly take completely for granted. Dharmakaya means the whole kit and caboodle. There is in the Freer Gallery in Washington a statue of Dharmakaya Vairochana Buddha, which is kind of a funny thing to make a statue of, but it's very beautiful. It's bigger than life size. I think it doesn't have a head anymore. It's very old. It's wearing an okesa like this. And inscribed all over the okesa are scenes of life. Little villages, farmhouses, farmer in the field plowing the ground, river running through, a pond with ducks in it. It's trying to embrace and express how life lives itself as Dharmakaya. Receiving the tremendous energy that burns in everything. We are burning. That's what life is. And this burning life, which takes form in all these perfectly ordinary ways. So it's not glamorous or remarkable even. It's just the amazement of how things are for us. So that's the three kayas. So when we remember them before we eat, it's huge. We bow at the Sambhoga kaya because we do that when we're sitting at table or when we're serving each other, because otherwise we're having to bow and bow and bow as we serve, going back and forth. And we decided many years ago that it would be easier to do one big bow on the Sambhoga kaya and let that stand for all the others. So we don't have to do any more than that one big bow. We receive the food in gassho, but we don't have to bow. It just makes it a little less complicated. So after the kayas comes the future Maitreya Buddha. That too is a concept that came along that, there must be a Buddha coming in the future. Many religions have that idea that it is returning. It went away, but it's going to come back. And that's what Maitreya is as a concept. In the Asian Museum, you can see some beautiful little Maitreya Buddhas. He wears a little crown. Whenever I go to see a newborn baby, I always think, ah, Maitreya Buddha. Maitreya's come back. Good. Good. Here's another one. And then all the Buddhas, past, present, and future. And sometimes when we chant this, the chant is in the 10 directions. All Buddhas, past, present, and future in the 10 directions. Which again makes it so big. This present moment contains the past and the future. It's all of a piece. And the 10 directions. There's no place that is not touched and pierced by Buddha. And then the Mahayana Samantabhadra Buddha Sutra is probably the first sutra after the Prajnaparamita Sutras that are in the Mahayana tradition. And it's depended on by many different flavors of Buddhism. It's considered to be the very word of Buddha. It's full of stories, wonderful stories, very simple stories, and very complicated pictures of how things are, descriptions. It's supposed to be Buddha's talking on Mount, on Vulture Peak. And he appears with thousands of bodhisattvas all around him and puts out a light from his forehead, psh, to all these thousands of bodhisattvas and Buddhas. So it's very, very Indian, very, very vast and colorful. And it's also a mandala. Many, many stories all around. Many expressions of trust in the Lotus Sutra and instructions to repeat it whenever we can. Respect it. That it is the word of Buddha and Buddha is preaching it on Vulture Peak. But try as you might, you can't find what Buddha actually said in it. It's a very curious exercise. The center of the mandala is empty. So you feel what's in the middle, but it's never expressed in words. I encourage you all to try it. It's a very interesting experience. One of the practices of the Lotus Sutra is to copy it. In fact, it advises a number of times, you know, a man or woman of good family would do well to copy the Lotus Sutra, something like that. And it's a marvelous practice. I've done it a couple of times. Little bit by little bit. Every day a page in my notebook. So whenever I run out of my notebook, I stop and then pick it up the next morning and do it again. You sort of take it inside that way. So that's the Mahayana Saddharma Pundarika Sutra. The great Lotus Sutra. Manjushri's next. Manjushri Bodhisattva is the Bodhisattva of the wisdom of practice itself. Zazen. In a Zendo, if it's only a Zendo, there's an image of only Manjushri. No Buddha. The Buddha goes in the Dharma hall and the Buddha hall. But in the Zendo, the sitters are Buddha itself. And Manjushri is riding on a lion as encouragement for us to sit on our lion. And sometimes he's shown with a sword to cut through all the baloney that goes on day after day as we sit. Manjushri, then Samantabhadra, the shining practice, bodhisattva. Samantabhadra is shown riding on an elephant. Taking the practice into the streets. Walking out and doing work. Being the Dharma. Avalokiteshvara, we all know, compassion, the infinite compassion bodhisattva. The bodhisattva with 1,000 hands and arms. And on every hand and eye, hearer of the cries of the world, ready to respond at any moment and in any guise. In the Lotus Sutra, there's a list of all the different ways Avalokiteshvara can appear. And it's a huge list, and you could go on and on with it too. It's not finished. But it includes butchers and hunters and prostitutes and, you know, all the dark side of human life, as well as noble and brave and wonderful beings. Whatever helps, that's Avalokiteshvara. And I often think how we forget how supported and helped we are in every way. How Avalokiteshvara truly does appear for us every single day in our life. In all the small ways of someone picking up something that we've dropped, or reminding us of something, or encouraging us in some way. Our own life is infused with the compassion of the world itself as it continues us, you could say. Namaha Prajna Paramita. The great practice of wisdom itself that carries us, the raft that carries us to the other shore. Whatever that is. So that's the Meal Sutra, Jane. You're welcome. And I can tell you quickly what the Echo is too, that there are names in there too, including oh, Shelley, you'll have to help me. looking upward, we deep. Now that we've chanted the Prajnaparamita Sutra, let us gather its merits with highest gratitude for our great teacher and founder, Shakyamuni Buddha, the first teacher in China, Bodhidharma.
First woman ancestor,
excuse me. Excuse me, Mahaprajapati. Oh, that's terrible. Mahaprajapati, the great Maha. Maha means great, and Prajapati is the name of Shakyamuni Buddha's stepmother, his mother's sister who raised him. And she's the one who persuaded Buddha, much against his will, to let her join the order. Let her and her friends and her servants and her relatives, all the women that she knew. And Buddha kept saying, no, it's not safe for women. It's not good for women. Women don't do these things. And no, you can't do it. And finally, Ananda, Buddha's assistant, begged for her, said, come on, Buddha. She really, really wants to do it. She came finally. She gave everything away. She shaved her head, and all the women that were worth her shaved their heads, and they made their own ukases, and they appeared for the third time at Buddha's door. And that's when Ananda said, you've got to do it. You just have no choice. So he did, reluctantly. And it was wise, that resistance, though we think it's crazy now, but it was dangerous for women. It still is in India, if you've ever been there. It's not an easy place to be as a woman wandering around all by herself, which is what the disciples were doing. So there were rules about it when he accepted them, about being at least two or three, I think, and other rules to protect and make it a little easier and better for them. So Mahaprajapati became not just a disciple, but a famous and wonderful master who didn't just wander around with a begging bowl, but became a great teacher herself. The first great woman teacher. So, I'm sorry I forgot her. In most Zen centers now, they, as well as reciting a long list of all the so-called ancestors, starting with Shakyamuni Buddha, or before Buddha, and all the way through the Indian ancestors, all the way through the Chinese ancestors, the Japanese ancestors, all the way down to our own teachers here in America, they also chant the names of about 15 women teachers, starting with Mahaprajapati and going through the ones that we can find out about in China and Japan. It's one that they keep refining. I saw a new version of it this summer. It's getting better and better. They also have dredged up some more information, as in Bodhidharma, the great Chinese teacher who brought the Dharma to China, or brought Zazen to China. His teacher was called Prajnatara. And if you really think about that name, they say now it was a woman who taught Bodhidharma, Prajnatara, wisdom of Tara. So there's Mahaprajapati and Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, Mahaprajapati. Gotta look. Bodhidharma, Ehe Dogen. Very complicated, wonderful teacher. Tengai Bunryu is Koban's father. All of the men in his family have Bun in their name, B-U-N. His brother was named Kebun. His Kebun's son, who is now the abbot of the temple, is Bune. Koban said the Buns go all the way back to Manjushri, that they're in Manjushri's line. I don't know how you would trace that back, but that's what he said. Hozan Koe is Koban's master. His father died when he was six, and he was adopted by the master of another little temple, a beautiful little temple in the same village where he grew up. If an abbot of a temple has no children, and Hozan Koe had no children, he and his wife, then they adopt somebody. And he becomes the abbot of the temple. He inherits it, because that's how it passes down. It goes through the family. So Koban was supposed to inherit Hozan Koe's position as abbot of Kotaiji, his little, beautiful little mossy temple. It was tucked back in a hill with moss all over, very green, very beautiful, trickling water going by. Instead, he got invited to come to America and asked his teacher's permission, and his teacher said no. And Coben came anyway. So he was in a lot of trouble for a long time in that town, which was very, very traditional. He just broke all the rules. Broke a lot of hearts because of it. His family was just had a very hard time accepting how radical this child of theirs was. Coben was the youngest son, so he could choose whatever he wanted to do. But of course, he'd already been adopted into this temple, and he was supposed to inherit it, and went to AHG and did the whole thing, and shone at AHG, went to the university, studied Buddhism, wrote his master's thesis on enlightenment. I mean, he was a part of the whole thing, and then ditched it all, presumably, to come to America. But of course, Soto Shu, the Soto school, considers him to be their best missionary. He was actually given the title of missionary for the work he did here, even though it was so off the wall compared to the way things are usually done in Japan, or were at that time. It's a very interesting story. Very touching story. He went through a lot. And then he's there, Ho-un Kobun, and Manjushri, and Avalokiteshvara, and then all the ancestors who've transmitted this Dharma to us. So are there questions about any of that? It's a lot, I know. Mm-hmm. Julian?
What's the name of the homeless kodo?
Kodo Sawaki.
Okay. Mm-hmm. There's that picture of him in Suzanne. Mm-hmm. And that picture's, I don't know if anyone has seen it, but where can you get pictures of like these masters? Like, I've been trying to find his picture.
I have no idea.
It's really hard to find it. I've seen it on it. Like, I mean, it's actually at Jikoji. Yeah. That picture. It's on the wall, and he's doing Suzanne. I mean, it's very powerful picture.
Yes.
I guess.
Well, you start on the internet, I guess.
Yeah.
Book on the masters. I had about a dozen masters.
Is he in there?
Oh, he was.
I think he might be.
He's really old too, and taken care of by
Uchiyama.
Yeah. It's a really wonderful picture. Looks
scanning. On the internet, that's some of his writings too.
Mm-hmm. He was homeless. Kodo, what he was called, because he didn't have a temple until late in his life. And then he had Antaiji Temple, but Coben sat with him whenever he came to Kyoto, where Coben was going to school, and he would do Sesshin, and people would gather around him for Sesshin. But he also was one of the first teachers to let Westerners come and sit with him at Antaiji, and Uchiyama Roshi continued that tradition and trained a lot of Americans I think Gary Snyder participated there. Yes.
What is this name?
The bowing mat?
Yeah, open this way.
It's to keep this from getting dirty and must. It's to protect it.
But during the talk, why is it left open this way? Is there something?
It's just waiting for me to come back. I will return. Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about what I was talking about last night. We were talking about trust and confidence and or confidence. Faith. And I thought I would bring up the question of what are we trusting? What do we have confidence in? It's hard to have confidence in the shaky self of us. We just get kind of at ease in one way or another, and then something sets us off balance again. We try to keep faith with ourselves, but it's pretty hard to do as life pushes us around, you could say. You can't really relax very easily because there's always something going to happen. Always something going to make a big switch. Sometimes it's a little one. And sometimes the little ones are even more upsetting than the big ones. How can we trust our life if it's always upsetting us? When we're really little, we just go along with everything. We don't really know the difference between ourself and everything else. And a big part of the process of growing up is slowly and sometimes with difficulty discovering, oh, I'm not a part of Mama. I'm not a part of the world. We begin to feel how separate we are. We begin to distinguish ourselves from others. It's an essential part of our growth. We have to be somebody. That's how we're made. But as we wake up to this self-consciousness, we also wake up at the same time to anxiety. Because there's a sense of not knowing what this is. And feeling that there's something here that we're trying to create, but it feels very uncertain. And so we begin the process of accreting a self from all the experiences that happen to us, keeping the things that make us look good, trying to get rid of the ones that we don't like, creating a self. At the same time, underneath, it's a very shaky feeling. Because, one, we're in life and we experience how uncertain life is. And two, we keep getting disabused of the notion that this self is a sturdy thing, because it keeps getting bruised and battered and knocked to pieces. So how do we trust ourself? I read a very interesting talk that Chogyam Trungpa gave about the self, in which he said a very curious thing. He said, isn't it interesting that we use others to confirm ourself? That we're always comparing ourselves to others and hoping to hear from others that we're okay, when the actuality is that we're already here, we know we're here, and we should be confirming others, not the other way around. Yes, I already know I'm here. Oh, there are other people here too. Huh. But instead, we're going up to others and saying, please, please tell me I'm okay. Tell me who I am. What am I? This kind of anxiety that goes with our insecurity. And much of sitting is about sitting down with our insecurity. And feeling our mind working to shore ourselves up. And feeling our mind facing itself as not just the good things come up, but all the things, or many of the things, some of which we would rather not know or admit. Koban's used to say at about this point in Sesshin, sometimes I feel like a dirty rag. Feel just kind of not so perfect. But meditation allows us, especially as we allow ourselves in, to begin to accept things as they are, and to see things as they are, not the way we want them to be, but as they have to be. It's a very humbling experience. Zazen is a very humbling experience. We come kind of proudly to the cushion often. I'm going to sit a whole week. Something great's going to happen. But actually, little by little, it all begins to fall off as we sit. And we begin to see how clearly how little we know and how little we can do ourselves. So we come to a kind of more honesty about our life. And perhaps a sense of how it is we are living. What's in us that lives us? Sometimes in the old stories they talk about what it is that lifts our eyebrows and blinks our eyes. The truth is our way to be in the world is to say outside of our control. And the more we're able to allow it to live itself, the more open we are to not knowing, the more authentic and more free life becomes. We don't have to make up a story about ourselves. We can be who we are at every moment without presenting a particular face. We don't need a reference point to tell us who we are. We don't have to be a certain way for the neighbors or for our parents or our spouses or for Big Brother. Fortunately, we live in a free country where we can actually enact the Dharma as our life without too much tyranny, except our own self-tyranny. So Chogyam Trungpa said an interesting thing about this, that if we allow ourselves to simply live an ordinary, humble life without trying to be somebody in particular. He said, because you appreciate impersonality, you become a person. You become from nothing, you go from nothing to somebody without pretense. Without having to pretend anything. So when we chant the Metta Sutra, the very last thing is about freed from the duality of birth and death. It's the duality of self and other that undermines our faith, our confidence, our trust. the trust in emptiness itself. Emptiness as we live. It very hard to talk about. We think when we walk across the room, I'm walking. We think when we talk, I'm talking. But if you carefully study yourself, you'll find you can't really say that anymore. Something talks. Something is walking. Provisionally we say I. But from my side, each one of our side, we don't know what it is. Dogen calls it a backward step. In Zazen, we take a backward step, turn around and begin to see what's inside us. A couple more days of sitting. I hope we sit as much, each of you sits as much as you possibly can. It's a little more widely scattered than usual because of the walk in the afternoon, but I encourage you to return to the cushion as soon as we get back. We have just this precious moment for this very interesting and important work that we're doing. Other questions? Lauren, do you know everybody here?
Almost.
Let's do introductions.
Sylvian.
Julie.
Jane. Samia. Lori.
Randy.
Lauren.
Yes, he's from San Francisco.
Sean.
Brit.
So glad you're here.
Wisdom is certainly not what you know, because everything you're telling us
reminding us that's not it. It's our bodies. It's empty. We can't hold on to it.
No.
And yet, here we are riding it.
Yeah.
I feel like I just said a little riddle. Okay, here's how I'm going to ask you a question. How do we contemplate wisdom?
Well, in the old-fashioned way of talking about this, the raft takes us from the shore of samsara to the shore of nirvana. So we practice wisdom, meaning zazen, essentially, that we offer ourselves to meditation, surrender ourselves to meditation, to the deep wisdom that's beyond our own machinations, that we can't do ourselves. And with that surrender, the idea is that then we achieve nirvana.
And you just told us last night that it's an unhidden world.
Yes. So if you really consider that, and consider your life, you begin to sense that maybe that's a kind of trick to get you going. It's a kind of carrot on the end of the stick. Oh, if I can just get over there and get to nirvana, everything will be okay. Just try so hard. But the thing is that there aren't two sides. So once we settle down, once we stop running around and stop trying to get somewhere, we realize this is nirvana itself, just as it is. So that's the truth of our practice.
So these words are beautiful, compassionate tricks that show us different sides.
Yes.
That at different points.
Yes.
Help us.
Yes. And another story with that one is that Buddha said, when you've use the raft to get to the other shore, you don't carry it with you after you get there. You put it down.
Oh, no. I thought you could carry it and go wherever you want.
No.
Just no. Go.
Meaning you let everything, all your understanding go. All your Dharma-ness and Buddha-ness and all the stuff that, and all your Zen-iness. And just live your life.
Oh, like that ferry, like the ferryman. Mm-hmm. Everyone thought he was just an old bum by the bridge.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Samsara is this life of terrible suffering. It's this life of hard edges, sharp corners. It's this life that's going to end in death, and probably a lot of pain before we end in death. It's this bleak place that makes us so discouraged and unhappy so often. Is this place where we're not understood, etc., etc., etc.
What is that? What was the question?
What is samsara? the world of suffering.
But at the same time, Buddha said life is suffering, and so once we kind of accept that, it's maybe not so bad, or... Yeah, there's a difference though,
yes.
Right?
Yes, yes. The first truth is that life is suffering.
Yeah,
you read that somewhere. Yeah, I did too. The suffering Buddha was talking about is not the world of hard edges and sharp corners, though, and the world of pain and death, because everyone has to suffer that. Everyone does. The suffering he was talking about is how we cling to our ideas about how things ought to be, especially cling to our ideas about who we are and who we want to be, and live in a dream world because we're not really here for what's actually happening. We're so busy trying to make this story up. And so he said, you can stop doing that by arranging your life, especially the way you view the world, the way you really see things and see yourself. You can stop suffering in that way.
The whole like self-examination is the real challenge, because
yes,
I mean, we still don't really know what's going on. We don't know what's in the head of, like, you know, people that we're dealing with, people that we're trying to treat kindly, but for some reason, whatever,
yes,
you know.
Yes.
What I was kind of thinking is wisdom. Part of the scary action is trusting in that.
Yes.
No matter, and not having any like kind of set
expectations
of what following that wisdom will bring.
Exactly. Exactly. You might get a punch in the nose, or not be understood, or who knows what.
So it goes.
Yes. Taking your seat, it's what I was saying last night too. If you take your seat where you are, and from there, your wisdom and compassion and love for the world is what you are and what you express. If you depend on the world, then you get shaky again. Then you're not where you are. You're out there somewhere. Feebly kind of trying to get your balance. So it means just sitting upright and deeply expressing the whole of what you don't really know, but what you feel so profoundly, with no expectation. Ritu?
Just thinking about what we were talking about yesterday and what Jim was talking about, nature and grieving, and we're talking again about suffering and rough edges. And, seems like for me, the more I practice, I guess it's detachment. I guess that's what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
So I still see everything and I feel it, but it's on this other level. Other than getting, like you said, getting off-center and pulled into this and pulled into that and feeling bad about this. Or
yeah.
As you get caught up in drama.
Yes.
You know, I'm just not interested in the drama. I guess what's interesting, it's kind of isolating. Because that seems to be how people do relate to each other.
What creates the isolation?
Because everyone's over there in the drama. And I'm like, come to my drama. No, I'm not cool. I'm not interested in your drama. And I guess there are ways to find.
Yes.
Somewhere else.
Well, Everything is Sangha. So when you're exploring and studying yourself, the more you study yourself, the more you realize how much you contain. You contain everybody. So that study of the self is not about you yourself, it's about being enlightened by everything else. So if you're feeling alienated, you're not there yet. You know, it's one thing to be impersonal, which is what Chogyam was talking about, but another thing to think of them as them. It's not them, it's you. So they all need your care and attention and your infinite compassion, especially if they're not as enlightened as you are. They need not your light, but an opportunity to shine their light on you. That's what we offer. That's what the first paramita is about, dana paramita, the giving. It's not that we're giving something, but we're offering the opportunity for people to shine. Everyone wants to shine. Yeah. Oh, Shelley.
We get caught up in our own self-drama.
Yes.
And that can, often that is the case. We think about our feelings, we think about me, not you, we think about I want, I need. And my feelings are the most important feelings in the world. And that is something I think that we all deal with, and in the midst of, say, some friends around me or a group around me or suffering around me, I find, hopefully not that, I'm thinking my thoughts and about me. And that's something that that we have to deal with in the best way that we can.
But we don't have to turn that off.
No, it doesn't turn itself off.
No. And it's not.
We're always going to have.
Yes. Yes.
I find there's different things. Even when we sit, it does.
Yeah. Yes. So, squirting out of us.
It's not a solid problem completely, although there's some ways perhaps to, I guess I'm presenting the problem more than answering it, but when I find myself feeling, for lack of a better word, self-centered, I find that helping someone else helps me more than it helps them. So that I'm doing good. So I'm helping someone else that's suffering, and that helps me.
It opens you up, yes.
And also in the midst of darkness and one's own suffering, that can be the greatest growth and enlightenment. And and happiness, because we've learned and we've transcended. Something dark arisen like a phoenix, you know, that's burned to ashes and then is alive.
I want to qualify that. That's beautiful. But I want to tell you a story about the king and queen who were having a little picnic and sitting under a tree. And the king turned to the queen and said, "Who do you love the best?" And she said, "Oh, King, I love you so much, but you know what? I love myself the best." And he said, "Oh, I'm so glad, my dear, because I love myself the best too." It's really important not to try to obliterate yourself or put yourself down. You're the most precious thing. Each one of us is the most precious thing. We just are so full of so many things, dark ones and difficult ones and all of that. And I think, so far in my life, the best we can do with all of that is bow to it. Oh, here comes that junk again. You know, well, hello. But it's not the whole thing at all. It's just part of it. And what I love about myself, what you love of yourself, isn't that junk. You know what you love, what's precious. We each of us do. But we tend to forget. We've been conditioned to forget. So one reason we come and sit together like this is so we can remember together and help each other deal with the junk as well as shine. As you do shine.
Sometimes, excuse me, but it's easier to love somebody else than yourself.
Yes. That's our work. That's our work.
That's common.
Takes more study. Yeah.
Can we ever love ourselves to the point of being selfish?
Well, sure. We do it all the time. That's what we're good at.
Is that really that? Is that really that?
No. Mm-hmm. No. Selfishness isn't the love that I was talking about. That's not what the king meant, or the queen. Mm-hmm. Well, it's 9 o'clock, so I hope we all have a good night's sleep tonight, and hope we have a good sit tomorrow. Thank you.